What specifically has Judaism taught you about life that has made your life better or has made the life of others better as well?
These four letters in Hebrew, Yud Heh Vav Heh, in English they would be YHVH. It's basically the verb to be in its manifestation. So it's basically saying, listen up, Jews, all that was, is, and will be, that is what is God. Everything forever is interconnected. So we are just the smallest aspect of this life force. And it's, to me, it's important that the verb is to be, which is totally beyond the material. And then the seventh word is, so ve'ahavta, go out with love, with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. And Harry, that is impossible to do 24/7, but it is a great aspirational and inspirational faith commitment. It's not just a feeling, this love, that it's a commandment, it's an obligation. And so I get this deep sense of we are here with an obligation to serve this life force with love in our heart, in our deepest consciousness, and in everything we do.
Welcome to another episode of Success with Purpose, where we help mentor you into becoming a more successful version of yourself. We do this through giving you access to mentors you typically would never have the opportunity to connect with. We explore their journeys, their experiences, their life-changing events, their fields of expertise, and most importantly, their purpose. My name is Harry Goldberg, husband to an incredible woman, father of two amazing daughters, host, interviewer, and interrogator of this podcast. And now, just before we learn from yet another exceptional guest, if you find value from these conversations, please make sure to like and subscribe below, leave a review. It really does make a difference. And of course, share with someone else who's going to find value. Now, listen in, pay attention, take some notes, enjoy. Let's begin. Rabbi Jeffrey Kamens, a pleasure to finally have you on Success with Purpose. Instead of introducing you the typical way of explaining your journey for those who are listening, I'd rather just share some verbatim of what one of your long-term colleagues has said to me about your success, and then we'll dive in from there. And you can definitely share your own journey throughout this conversation. Okay. And I'll read it here. Quote, great leadership, successfully consolidating, growing a diverse community, successful offering a diversity of ways to practice Judaism with reform, Masorti, renewal, whereas other communities fail to do this entirely, growing and nurturing a great team around him. And so as that being the foundation of this conversation of defining success, how do you define it? What's success to you?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons I've been, ducking and diving over this conversation is I actually have problems with the word success. There's part of it that just sounds too ego-based that makes me feel uncomfortable. I don't even, and maybe because people think about success often in terms of material success or just even outcomes and measurables and things like that. And that language just doesn't sit well with me. It's not how I operate. And so I kind of feel like I operate more in the world of the intangible or the amorphous, which is therefore hard to measure in that sense. I like talking about things like meaning, purpose, fulfillment, and that kind of thing. And in terms of, you know, how others may choose to look at the work we do here at Emmanuel Synagogue, whether it's successful or not, you know, I'll leave that to them to judge. I always feel like there is far more to do than has already been accomplished, if that makes sense.
Okay, so if I'm hearing you correctly, you're kind of defining success for you more along the terms of meaning, purpose, and fulfillment. And as part of how intangible that is for you, it often feels like it can never even be achieved because there's always more to do.
Correct.
Well, then in that sense, how do you start to identify that you're on a meaningful, purposeful and fulfilling path that you're on?
Okay. So, and this, the teaching I want to share kind of relates to part A, success, and part B, meaning, you know, there's that famous teaching in the wisdom of our sages from about 2,000 years ago, Pirkei Avot. Interestingly enough, it's one of the readings that's selected to be part of the liturgy at a funeral. Lo alecha hamelecha ligmor, it's not upon you to complete the work, but neither are you free to desist from it. And so I think to me, I define all of that as, and especially how I understand my life as a Jew, living my Judaism as a pathway in life, is that we are here to live a life of service and a life of avodah, which is, if you want to call it, you know, worshipful or sacred work on the planet. And that's what gives me meaning. And I try to share that with others and hope that it gives them meaning too.
And how do you know that you're fulfilling a life of service in Adava?
I guess I feel it just in what I do, you know, day in and day out. And I think it's what you do for others. So in other words, I don't, to me, you know, I like being happy more than sad, but happiness isn't my, I don't measure my life by happiness. I think about, you know, maybe this has to be, go to being a kid, you know, when, as a, in a secular household, and, you know, even as a little boy, remembering the words that then were oft repeated from, you know, President John Kennedy, you know, don't ask what, you know, your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country. And it's that kind of thing. Don't ask what others can do for you, what you can get out of life, but what you can give back to life, what you can give back to others. And so, you know, day in and day out, I just try to be present and giving for others, I guess. It's, you know, when it works, it's deeply satisfying.
And when it doesn't work?
Then I don't sleep well. And I reflect, okay, you know, what, where did I miss, you know, you know, and so I guess over the decades, I feel like I've, you know, matured a lot. I don't get angry as often. I don't get as reactive as often. So, you know, those are the places that in terms of my own personal meaning, you know, and fulfillment, that's what I try to do, is grow as a human being.
We're going to dive into your journey in a moment, but throughout your whole journey, you've basically continued upwards, right? You went and you actually, before we dive into that, we're going to circle back to how success has actually played out, or how this continual growth and increase of impact and purpose, by your definition, has continued to play out, because it sounds like it's been very intentional. But at the same time, you're like, well, it's like, you know, achievement and getting there hasn't really been the forte, hasn't been the primary focus, but it's definitely been a focus. So why don't we explore a little bit more of your journey? And you can start from the beginning, right? Not the beginning of time, but beginning of your time, up to where you are today. If you want to let the people who are listening assume that they don't know anything about your journey, let's start there.
So I'm definitely a product of a secular home in Los Angeles, post-war, baby boomer in that sense. So I think these are important factors in who I am. I've spoken about it a lot and I've written about it. So let's go back to the, you know, the ancestors I don't know, which are my great-grandparents, who fled from various Eastern European communities near Kiev, near Odessa, near Riga, somewhere in Moldova, in a little small farming community in the 1880s, which, if one knows history, is a time yet again of pogroms against Jews in Eastern Europe. So they fled to what was known as the Golden Country of the United States. And like many Jews of that time, kind of left their practice of Judaism behind. So all my grandparents were born in Chicago in the 1890s, and pretty much already were growing up in secular homes. It was one of those things that the communities stayed together in terms of culture and people, but there wasn't a lot of Jewish practice in any of the homes. And then my father came to LA when he was seven. My mom was already born in LA. This is back in the 1920s. So, you know, you're talking through and through United States culture, but really in a California sense. That's a whole other story if you want to go in there, but probably not. But whenever people ask me where I'm from, I always say I'm from California, not from the United States, because we're definitely, a different outlook. And, the size of things, I think California would be the sixth or seventh largest economy in the world if it were a separate country. And often we feel, you know, very different than the rest of American culture. So I really grew up in a California bred culture. my father was an atheist, outspoken atheist. My mom, clearly agnostic, never really had much interest in these kinds of things. But my grandparents, felt very proud. Everybody was very proud of being Jewish. And I grew up in a neighborhood. And for those in Australia, or especially in Sydney, basically like Bellevue Hill, but it was called Encino. It's a suburb of the San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles. Post-war, I would say 90% of the people in my public elementary school, primary school, as we say in Australia, were Jewish. So it was just like part of the culture, part of the friendship group. Very few practicing observant people. We never lit Shabbat candles. We never went to synagogue. I didn't celebrate being a bar mitzvah when I was 13 years old. I had no Jewish learning at that time. But, you know, this is the 1960s I'm growing up. And so there's all that kind of energy that's happening in the United States about the civil rights movement, you know, the Vietnam War protests. I'm quite engaged politically. So, you know, from John Kennedy and the Cuban Missile Crisis being some of my earliest memories as a five-year-old, to his assassination, to the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy, to being very aware of racism. All these kinds of things are part of my growing up experience in this very Jewish neighborhood. And my dad is a highly influential person in my life, very much what we would call a lefty, you know, in the vernacular, very committed to social justice. And this is why when we fast forward to a religious spiritual life, the most ethical person, highest integrity. And so therefore, I don't believe one needs to believe to know the difference between right and wrong, and to do that which is right and avoid that which is wrong. My mom, very, very creative person, she was a singer, an actress. My father passed away 25 years ago. My mom's still living. And, that's one of the reasons LA is still such an important part of my life, as well as all the rest of the family I have there. And the other influential people in my life are my mom's auntie, her father's sister, who started living in Israel in the 1960s. And my father's mother, my grandmother, who just was one of the kindest, most generous and grounded human beings that you could ever know. And everybody was a proud Jew, but no one was, you know, practicing Judaism, and no one was a believer. Me, on the other hand, I remember from being a little kid having a sense of presence. And I didn't know how to articulate that. So it just like kind of hovers in the background. And so I grow up in this community. All my friends are basically Jewish. And then I go to university where hardly anybody is Jewish. And it was just the outbreak of the Yom Kippur War. And so there, all of a sudden, I realized there was something unique to my identity as a Jew, that it really was not where most people held or not where most people thought. And at the same time, while that was happening, you know, you're at university. This is when you even deepen your spiritual explorations. But oddly enough, and maybe it was because of the women to whom I was attracted. One was a Buddhist, Japanese background. Another was a Catholic, Irish, Mexican background. And, you know, so I started studying, you know, a little bit of Eastern tradition. I read the Christian scriptures, the Gospels as they're known. But I would bump into things that just didn't ring right or true for me. And then I took my first trip to Israel when I was 19, and that really deepened my sense of being connected to a people. And remember in the 1970s, well, you can't even remember, you weren't born. But, you know, for those people who were alive then, you might remember that the 1970s is kind of like when the rise of a lot of, ethnic consciousness is happening within various groups, whether it be, you know, the Latino group, the Asian group, the Black American group. And so, you know, me as a Jew, I started, you know, feeling my ethnicity even more. And, you know, but a typical, person in teens and 20s, kind of at a loss of things to do. So naturally, I just kind of went, to what was, waters flow where they flow. And my father being an extraordinarily accomplished lawyer, and I not knowing what I really wanted to do after university, I went to law school and did not enjoy it from day one. And so I took some time away and spent more time in Israel. And that led to my wanting to deepen my, awareness. And when I came back from living on a kibbutz for over a year, in parentheses, right now down near Gaza. And it was a very, very different time back then. And it's sad that things have gone absolutely pear-shaped instead of where there could have been potential to go in a different direction. I came back to Los Angeles. Excuse me. It's now the early 80s. And I met a woman who would become my first wife, who was working in my dad's law office. And she wanted to study more about Judaism. So it was only my, like I was 24, 25, that I began the study of Judaism. And now I'll make a long story short. And eventually that led me, after, finishing my law studies, working briefly as a lawyer, deciding that was not the path, quitting and thinking, what do I want to do? And there was a moment, deep, deep moment of realization in conversation with someone else, where the idea after studying in synagogue with Babette came around to, I think I want to be a rabbi. I had no clue what a rabbi really did other than seeing the guy up there at the, the Bima, giving a sermon every now and then. But I liked that idea.
If I can jump in quickly, what was that?
Okay, so
deep conversation.
Yeah. Okay, it's pretty trippy. I like it. Was very, okay. So I'd worked as a lawyer for a year, I said, and didn't enjoy it. And so I quit. Really, I was back to not knowing what to do. But by this time, I'm, how old was I? 27. So, I knew there were certain things that were meaningful to me. Teaching was one of them. Talking deep about ideas and meaning and living a purposeful life was another. And I went on a little journey in California because having been on kibbutz and really attracted to the idea of being a socialist farmer, there was a small commune up in the Bay Area, and I'd been kind of in touch with the people there off and on for a few years. So I thought I would go explore that, now that I'd met Babette, and maybe we wouldn't, living in Israel might be too difficult. Maybe, the life on a commune might work. And I find this is a story I've shared, once or twice. There was a woman there who did flower essence, kind of like spiritual guidance. Now, I don't believe that the flower essence spiritual guidance works because, you know, I was putting the, you know, the homeopathic drops and, you know, on my tongue three times a day or however many times a day it was, but rather I was having, you know, I had to choose which flowers with which properties I wanted. And I actually have the little bottle still somewhere in a drawer in my house in LA, just to remind me. But they had to do with these ideas of love and service and things like that. Okay, so I've been doing that for a few weeks. I come back to LA and I go back to the synagogue where I'd done some student teaching for a little while. And I was talking to a person there, you know, about what am I going to do in life? You know, I'm, you know, almost 28 years old now. I've, you know, got great degrees, but no desire to practice law. And she said, have you ever thought of being a social worker? And to all those social workers out there, my absolute commendation to the extraordinary work that you do day in and day out for so little reward. And it just felt that it was too much focused on a small area of support for where I wanted to be. She asked, have you ever thought of being an educator? Now that rang more true to me in the sense that I love teaching. I love working with kids of all ages, especially teenagers though. And, you know, so I thought even of being a high school teacher, but I'd been doing, you know, kind of a little part-time high school teaching while I was in this, what am I going to do next? And you have to deal with parents. You have to deal with problem kids. You have to deal with administration and paperwork. And again, it's really hard to support a family on a teacher's salary. And so it's like, oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I'm not quite sure. I'm, you know, mulling it over. And she says, have you ever thought of being a rabbi? And Harry, I got to say, like this ran through my body, a vibration, a chill. It was like, bing. I knew in that instant that she said that, that that's what I was going to do. And as I said, I'd only been going to synagogue really with Babette for a year and kind of like getting a sense of what the rabbi does. But I guess I wanted a, you know, if I were to define how I thought of that, a spiritual community leader or a leader of a spiritual community. And there you go. That took me off on the journey. 5 years of rabbinic school, first job here. And here I am 34 years later. I've lived more than half my life in Australia now than and it's kind of crazy. I never thought that, never saw that one coming.
Didn't see that one coming. Who is this woman who was asking you these questions?
Babette is my first wife.
Right.
Okay. She's passed away.
So Babette was the one asking you these questions.
You would remember Babette maybe from when you were a little kid. And so she was older than I was. And so through here, I was gifted two stepdaughters who were teenagers, and they stayed back when we moved to Sydney in 1989. But already everybody had children young on her side of the family. So I have, you know, stepdaughters in LA. Well, one's in New York now, one's in LA, two grandchildren in LA. And as I said, everybody likes having children young. I have three great grandchildren with one more on the way, all through, you know, Babette's side of the family. So I'm very, very blessed. And she was a huge influence in my engagement with Judaism as life learning and life practice.
This is beautiful. So your life partner at the time, your wife,
correct,
was the one challenging you on what you actually want to do. So she was the one helping you with...
Well, actually, she'd grown up in a very small town in a community where she'd gone to synagogue. And like my family was just grateful when I said, I'm going to be a rabbi, that I wasn't going to be a bum, you know, like an unemployed person with no clue.
It's not the worst
lost
thing
in
you
life,
say,
seriously.
Right?
Whereas my Babette, because she'd grown up in a synagogue and her father had been the president of the synagogue, it was like, are you insane? Do you know what a rabbi does? You know, and, you know, boards and congregants and stuff like that. So in terms of the engagement with Judaism, Absolutely. But, you know, thinking that it might be a bit of a mad project to become a rabbi, you know, she was, you know, she knew the most. So, and it hasn't always been easy. There was a point in life we went our separate ways in terms of the marriage, but never in terms of the friendship. And as I said, she passed away almost 9 years ago now. Meanwhile, and this is very interesting, I'm very, very happily remarried to a woman whose challenges go on a total different sense, very proudly engaged as a Jew, but much more from my father's perspective on things.
The cultural side
In
rather than
terms
the
of, you
spiritual
know,
side.
and in terms of practice, and definitely coming from a, you know, a more secular, approach to things. Absolutely.
A lot of people would be hearing this and saying, okay, this is really interesting. I'm listening to a rabbi who has shared that his marriage went separate ways. And there probably aren't that many people who know of rabbis who have been remarried. And so from a, especially
There are
from your
actually
spiritual
a few in
practice.
Sydney.
Yeah, okay. Right. There you go. I don't know that many. What are you happy to share about the state of the relationship? What kind of eventuated that like what were the
No,
key
that I'd
factors
like to
that led
keep.
to, okay. Oh, are you
Yeah, no,
happy to share
that's
any?
yeah, that I'm gonna hold that in my private realm. I'll just share two things. One, we always loved each other very, very deeply, and I was by her side when she passed away. And you know, as I said, her family is my family, or our family is our family. And it was, you know, an incredible selfless gift she gave to me. But our understanding of Judaism and its, you know, practice ended up being very different. You know, so and I think she became much more traditional, and part of our family is much more traditional, but that's not my comfort zone. I have absolute huge love and respect for those people who in our family have chosen that path, which is one of my, you know, my stepdaughter, my grandchildren for the most part. But yeah, I needed a, given where I came from, I need a little bit more fluidity in my spiritual approach in life.
What can people learn about relationships as a result of, like, in terms of choosing the right partner or how much to invest into their marriage or into their relationship? What can you share with people from your own life experience, but also you've married countless couples by now, and you've seen them grow and you've seen them have kids and you've seen them develop, and you've probably seen countless divorces and separations as well. What have you learned over the years that you're happy to share with the guests
Someone, I
about?
was just officiating at a wedding for someone a couple of weeks ago, and they said, "What would you know, guide us to?" And I would say, always be honest, you know, always have your partner's back. They are your number one. Right, not your, you know, once you get married, it's not about, you know, love, honor your mother and your father always, you know, that's what it says in the Torah. But when you get married, that is your you know, that's your number one. And so have their back, be open and honest, and through that, you know, God willing, you'll, you know, grow together in mutual understanding and support. So yeah, that's what I would say.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for sharing as much as you have. All right, so there was a separation, never in friendship, but in the marriage. And where did that journey lead you to? Where were you at that time when the separation was made?
That
Where
was
were you
actually
in
interesting. It
your
was
journey?
right. Yeah, no, it was not long after my there was it was a time of huge tumult in my life. It was in the footsteps of my father's death. It was right around the time I became senior rabbi, and it was this kind of time where I had to explore where I wanted to go on my journey. And that was probably maybe a 10-year struggle. Yeah, it took a long time to work that out. And it hasn't been easy. There have always been challenges. Kaz and I were just talking about this the other day, and I don't want to go deep into it only because it then ends up, I hate using the word politics, but I think going back, Harry, yeah, I think I've had a vision for what I would like for a community, and I've tried to share that vision. But within any community, a synagogue is kind of like a small town to a certain extent. You have a board, you have other people you have to work with, you have people that, you deeply rely on to support you in the vision. And you mentioned at the very beginning, building a collaborative team has taken decades. And, the first decade would have been the hardest. Those were a lot of the issues. There were a lot of personal struggles, in that period of time, getting to, the next stage. But I'm deeply grateful. So two of my colleagues, Rabbi Jacqueline Nino has been by my side since the year before I became the senior rabbi, 26 years coming on now, and has been absolutely an incredible support and leader. Now, like so much a confidant that I would say at least for the last 10, 15 years, there wouldn't be anything I do that I don't run by her for her opinion, her insight, her advice. And and then there was another friend, colleague that we started the conservative or the Masorti or the traditional path together in the 1990s. And then he was overseas for 20 years and he's come back. And again, just someone whose wisdom I deeply cherish. And it's I couldn't do what I do without them and my other colleagues as well.
Okay. And so you had this vision of creating of turning the community into a real community, like a town you were referring it to it as. What clearly was the vision when you started? How has that changed over time? And what do you feel that you've achieved of it?
Okay, so I grew up in a secular home. When I was studying Judaism with Babette, we went to a Reform, as it's called in the United States, synagogue. The most inspirational teacher that I found was someone they brought in one night that then I began private studies with, who was a Chabad rabbi. And so I think given how I was raised as a Jew, I've always understood that we are a people. We have an extraordinary history and heritage. One of my greatest pains right now is the dismissal of that by so much planetary consciousness, the lack of recognition of our historical connection to the land of Israel, as we call it. But, that our presence there goes back thousands of years and we're put into a box of settler colonialists is very upsetting personally to me. It feels like that dismissal of my culture and my people that I would never do to anyone else, including Palestinians. I absolutely, respect Arab culture and presence in the land as well. It's to me, it's not either or. It's all of us together. But I came from that sense that we are an incredibly historical people with an amazing rich heritage that, comes not only through Europe, but through, the East and all kinds of things. And that over the last few hundred years, we've developed kind of practices that are varied. I remember reading when I was among my spiritual searches, Carlos Castaneda's The Teachings of Don Juan, which is, you know, kind of a, you know, anthropological story, maybe how real it is in terms of his experiences with Don Juan and how much it's fictionalized. You know, no one knows for sure, but there's some profound insights into life. And one of the things in one of his first books, he quotes, you know, Don Juan as saying is, you know, there are a billion paths, you know, in life, and choose a path with heart. And I think people have to have an open, heartfelt path, and people have to have an open, mindful path. And just because something is written doesn't make it so. So my approach to Judaism, and why, despite the guidance of the Chabad rabbi, Rabbi Shlomo Schwartz, and he was very inspirational and influential in my Jewish studies, I could never believe that God, as I understand it, dictates books to people, whether it's our Torah, the Christian Bible, or the Islamic Quran. These are all human creations. So I wanted to create a community that broke down the barriers among Jews as to I'm Reform, I'm conservative, you know, I'm Orthodox. All these things are just labels. And so I think one of the, you know, sayings that I've had that we've adopted is that the more doors that we can open into the community, the more people can come through. And so if you were going to say of the visions, it was always a very, very inclusive vision. And then Rabbi Nino has been really inspirational to make it even more inclusive. She was the original champion in the Jewish community, and I would say among religious leaders in all of Australia, for the inclusion of, you know, as we called it back then, gay and lesbian people, and, you know, eventually, you know, the whole range of gender fluidity. And then we expanded that to even saying, if you feel comfortable within this synagogue on your spiritual journey, you don't even have to be a Jew. You know, you can join this spiritual community if this is a place that you find meaning and connection. And so I don't know that I saw all those things happening when I started in 1989, but in terms of wanting it to be as inclusive and broad a community, that was a vision that I had way back then.
What have been some of the challenges, or maybe even the drawbacks, of making it as inclusive as it's been?
Oh my goodness. Challenges, many. I remember, like, all through the 1990s, it was trying to teach people that being diverse is not divisive. You know, it's just the opposite. So that took, 15, 20 years to get that through. So that was, it took conversations and teachings. I guess one of the attributes would be, you know, being able to have a long-term goals and patience. And I think that's the advantage. So I'm here 34 years, whereas a lot of rabbis, certainly in the States, they're somewhere for 3 years, for 5 years, 10 years. You can't achieve what we've been able to do as a synagogue without there being, you know, just long-term conversations and, you know, generational change. And I remain open to seeing where it goes after I slow down from being the senior rabbi. It'll be very exciting to watch.
Okay, so you've started talking about some interesting perspectives. You mentioned that being diverse is not divisive, or doesn't have to be divisive, whereas many in the world are becoming.
It shouldn't be divisive.
Right, shouldn't be divisive. And how have you managed to make it so that it's not? Because, I mean, especially in the world today, it seems like most of the division is coming as a result of people wanting to be different from others and claiming that they're different so that they can belong in another group. And you've managed to
Harry, that old
navigate that.
thing that you know that old thing that I remember being asked in the United States, and I can see it coming up, in Australia. Are you a Jew first or an Australian first? You're a Jew first or you're an American first? And it's like, choose my deep ethnic identity, as I explained earlier in telling my story. And I learned that the answer is I'm a human being first. We're all just human beings. We're all just, wandering our way through this life. And most human beings want the same thing: peace, security, dignity, maybe a little love as well, as always nice to have. And so to try to create that for people and let them in this little place that we call Emmanuel Synagogue, where people can speak their different voices, if you want to call it from the right to the left or whatever, and just understand that they can be heard, and it's not my power over you, but our empowerment together to try to create the community we want, the society we want. And you can only do that through open, honest conversation, and to say, what are our basic assumptions and what are our ultimate goals and visions and values? And so it's been that kind of struggle. But I think it, and as I say, it just takes a lot of patience and perseverance. And I think we were lucky that we started this before the age of social media, because I think I don't spend any time on social media, but the little that I see things, I find it so deleterious to this kind of work.
And social media has been around for what now? Since around 2007, 2008. So we're talking at least a good 15, 16,
Yeah,
17
but really,
years.
like in the last. Yeah, but in the last decade, I think it's really taken off, and so growing a whole generation of people locked into their silos and their inability. But it also, it's the latest, the algorithms that, this isn't my area of expertise, but can you imagine if you built an algorithm that, preferenced statements of inclusion and statements of love? But they don't sell, because humans still, sadly, fear and animosity just, get the energy going and build the sales. And so that's what I mean. It just makes it very, very difficult to have these, more thoughtful, considered kinds of conversations, to be able to have things that involve patience, perseverance, and setting long-term goals. Makes it much more difficult in my mind. I prefer to do everything in person, having a conversation like that and really nutting things out and slowly building those kinds of ideas.
Yeah, I remember listening to a podcast just a few weeks ago of someone who used to be editor in chief of a very large news outlet, and he was sharing that the if he were to write a really positive article versus a really negative article, even if it's about the same thing, but a positive title versus a negative title, the negative one is going to have somewhere between 90 to 95%. Compared to the 5 to 10% of clicks that the other one's going to have. So we're literally talking about 10 to 20 times more views from something which is negative and really targets people's negativity bias. So you're saying that your way around this has been to have as much in-person as possible and continue to try and allow people to connect in the best ways possible and open and feeling safe. And you seem to feel very negative and pessimistic towards social media or where that's headed. How have you been combating that over the last 10 years, and how do you hope that you'll be able to continue to combat it, both for the individuals but then also for the community as a whole?
I think that, it's just a little by little, and one of the things that we're going to try to do here. I mean, the whole situation about what's going on within Israel, the war in Gaza, but Israel and Palestine on a bigger sense, and then what that's leading to in terms of animosity to Jews, and I imagine also to Muslims. Obviously that's not my world, so I don't experience it personally, but people speak about it, and so I don't doubt it. Is to start to try to build relationships. One of the questions I've been asked is, after October 7th, what happened in the interfaith world? And in all honesty, it went quiet at first. I don't know if that was because, it was so shocking, people didn't know what to say, or because of political persuasions, people didn't want to speak, or that is irrelevant to me. For whatever reason, for the first few months, it was quiet. And then I would say toward, the end of November, conversations started to happen and conversations continue. And I'm talking about among religious leaders, community leaders. And I'm not going to affect Middle East politics. I'm not going to affect world politics. I think that's what happens at Davos with all the people with all the money. It's like the insanity of how few people have so many of the, resources of the planet. And then, the autocrats who are running the, the countries, on this global scale, I don't know how effective any of us can be. And so it's in the personal, relational, communal space. And so here at the synagogue, we're trying to create those spaces for those multicultural interfaith conversations. And as those happen, they won't be the only ones, and we won't be the only ones. It goes back to that, statement from Pirkei Avot, Lo alecha melacha ligmor. This is not going to be done in our lifetimes. And I don't know if the transition for humanity will happen. I don't know if it will happen peacefully, but I will do everything to in my ability to enable that. And what I mean by that transition is that, we are and have been a violent species. We're a destructive species, but we're also an incredibly intelligent and imaginative species, and more people are becoming aware. And this is the advantage of the global communication that we have, of the havoc and disaster that we human beings are wreaking on this planet and for all sentient life on it and for our fellow human beings. So, it's like I want to be part of that conversation that says, how can we do things differently? And I think it can only start at first in a communitarian way, in a real way.
And that obviously comes back to this part of the conversation about the vision, how you're trying to implement the vision and you're attempting to implement it through community. Is that right?
And I guess I would say, I'm just trying to think how many. I would say for the first 30 years, Harry, it was really here at the synagogue, right? And maybe this is kind of what you're, trying to guide me gently to. I feel like Emmanuel Synagogue is in a really great place. I have extraordinary colleagues, an extraordinary support staff, just so loyal, so dedicated, so giving. A board that actually deeply supports the work and helps lead with it. So it's like all those elements that it took forever for all of them to coalesce. And I really feel like we've gotten there. So at this point in my career, so put the number down, I'm about to turn 68. What I'd like to do is to just, ensure that that's where Emmanuel Synagogue continues to sit, and to be able to hand over the baton carry on, as I said, in the way that she would continue. She's got an extraordinary, as I say, she would be, when it comes to that sense of inclusivity and compassion and understanding, she is, inspirational. And then we could also, I'm not running away, move this to the next level of conversation beyond the synagogue, working with other Jewish leaders, because there are great Jewish leaders in Australia, working with other faith leaders. And those are the people that I'm, starting to reach out to. And at the same time, working with other human beings, because there are so many human beings in this amazing country in which we live, who are open-hearted and open-minded and do want to have a better future for all of us here, one that's, much more just and equitable and compassionate. And, and that's where my faith comes in. I really do believe we can do that.
Okay. And in what you're sharing, you even use the words of, I feel like Manuel Synagogue has finally gotten there. But right in the beginning of the conversation, you referenced that the work's never done. You're never anywhere near the success that you're trying to achieve.
When I say gotten there, got fair enough, but gotten there to a place where I don't feel like I have to struggle for us to be the community that I want us to, that I've wanted us to be. I feel we are the community that we can continue to organically grow, right? The foundations, the structures are basically there now. So we can now continue that work, which, as I said, now is also about outreach, right? So it's like you need to have that kind of solid core, or and so that's what I mean by there. But there then has to go beyond there, just to be a little synagogue, and that's important. And a lot of our work, as you know, is and especially my work, is pastoral work, dealing with all the various life cycles, guiding people through crisis moments in life, and a lot of it is educational, and that's where you can still be influential and all these kinds of things. But that's all I meant, is that I really feel like when I came here, when I came here, it was like a reform synagogue, a very limited scope, right? In my mind, I could be wrong and people could correct me. I wanted it to be much more expansive and inclusive. We're much more inclusive. Now we're going to go expansive. Okay. If that makes sense.
That makes sense. And what I've just heard in what you shared there is that there's been a lot of Rabbi Jeffrey Kamen's energy put into this sense of inclusion and sense of community. And that's ultimately been the majority of the work that's happened. There's been a lot of your energy, and you've built an amazing team. You've had some wonderful conversations that you've said, really long-term conversations and dialogue to make sure they're all on the same page. But it sounds like I'm speaking to someone who's from a tech startup and founded it and started building it out, but it still was only really growing because of the amount of energy that they were putting into it. Is that for much?
Oh,
of
no,
the,
definitely not.
For much of the
no,
30
no,
years,
I don't want that to be. It's not like, first of all, when I came, Rabbi Fox, who was, the senior rabbi then, gave me huge encouragement in this work. There's no way I could have done what I did without the support and encouragement of a senior rabbi like him, right? And it's not the norm, right? It's not the norm. So he set that model up for me. The synagogue already was coming from a place that it was involved in interfaith work and social justice work. Those things go back to its foundation in 1938. So I wasn't, creating something from nothing. It was just, my first place of inclusion was just, taking it from being a reform synagogue to broadening its understanding of Judaism. That was that, you know, that's been my innovation, so to speak. You know, the notion that you, and now there are other synagogues out there that, you know, either call themselves multi-denominational or post-denominational. So that would, you know, it was something that was going around in the United States for some time. So it's just that we would, you know, and my dream, and I think with Rabbi Mordechai as well back then, was for us to be post-denominational, so to speak. But, you know, that isn't yet in Australia's comfort zone, so we're multi-denominational. But my dream would be, it's like, and I say it to people, I'm just a Jew doing Judaism. Don't call me Reformed. Don't call me conservative. You know, it's like, you know, we just have, Judaism is a life practice. And, you know, I find myself there and you find yourself there. And, you know, it doesn't matter as long as you, you know, feel engaged where you're at. I don't have, the only place I, you know, judge others is when they mistreat others or make others wrong for something that is not morally or legally wrong, right? That's, you know, that's what rubs me up the wrong way. Other than that, you know, because you said, what are the problems with inclusion, you know, and stuff like that, and diversity, you know, as long as you, you know, speak honestly and not with deceit, as long as you, and I use the word deceit, that could get me off on a whole train of things that make me crazy in this world. As long as you don't lord your power over someone else, but try to help empower, you know, these are the things for which we strive. And I came in a community that was very open to that. So it's not the same thing as starting something from scratch or that kind of thing. And I would hate that first hour of our conversation led it, you know, people, listeners out there, to think that's what I'm saying. No,
that's not what I've ever seen in you. That's why I was questioning it, because that's how it's starting to sound. But I mean, so you've always had the support. But then at the same time, you've made sure that the support that you've received, you've then been able to pass on. Other people have been able to have a lot of support from you as a result. How have you continued to build the team? How have you continued to build the team in a way that continues to focus on the direction of the vision?
Yeah. And that's where the slowly comes. For example, you know, as I said, Rabbi Nino and I have been together forever, and it's like, great. And then, like, who's going to be next? And it just took a long time. And actually, the third person to come on was Rabbi Rafi Kaiser-Bluth. And it was just like, we actually, Rabbi Nino and I, suffered for a few years where it was just the two of us with some different people coming in and out to give support. But it was worth, when I say suffered, we didn't have, you know, we weren't able sometimes to take all our leave and things like that. It wasn't like huge suffering like is happening on planet Earth. But in other words, we chose to have those implications for our imbalance in work and leisure in order not to have a person who would be inappropriate for the organic growth of the team. And so that's what I mean by patience and perseverance. There were a lot of people who came in to, you know, for interviews over many years from overseas, locally, and it just somehow we knew it wasn't the right fit, right? And so you just take your time, and so it's an organic growth and development takes a lot longer.
You have five rabbis now, right? Yourself, Rabbi Nino.
Yeah. And so Rabbi Kaiser-Bluth was our third. And then Rabbi Mordechai, as I said, he and I were together as kind of like, if you want to say, the Young Turks back in the early 1990s. He went overseas to study to be a cantor because he's a, you know, a musical talent and inspiration and knows how to nurture young talent and build spiritual network and singing community that is beyond anything I could ever hope to achieve. He was always kind of like, you know, one of the missing cogs in the wheel. And he and I never lost touch, and I always wanted to bring him back. And it took till 2019, finally, for personal reasons of his work and family life in the United States before we could do that. And his presence here has totally transformed the congregation, as I knew it always would already. And he was a cantor studying part-time, so he became a rabbi just a couple years ago. And then the fifth person is Sam Zwornstein, who has been rock solid on our team in various roles, always had a deep desire to be a rabbi. He actually came in as a congregant, started doing some bar mitzvah teaching and leading of services because of his engagement with Judaism, was our general manager, became our reverend in charge of pastoral care because he's got a deep, deep heart. And he also did some rabbinic studies recently. And so he got his rabbinic ordination just a little over a year ago. And so that's how we end up having five rabbis. Rabbi Mordechai is our director of liturgy and music as well. And Rabbi Zwornstein is our director of pastoral care. And each person on the team is a rock on whom we all rely.
And that's the clergy. What about the rest of the team? Because it's kind of a manual.
Then after that, then we just have a great staff from people who do the accounts and the marketing and the communication, a beautiful executive director, and youth educators and things like that. So, and obviously that's one of the things we really want to do is to reach out to younger people. We do have a lot of younger people who are involved in the community, but I think that there are so many people, I really deeply believe this, between 20 and 40 who are hungry for a life of connection and meaning, that even though that they may spend a lot of time on social media, they know it's not ultimately satisfying in that place of engagement and purpose. And so that's our next thing, is to try to create the space for those kinds of levels of engagement. And so these are the conversations as a whole team we're beginning to have as to, what we can do. And the other thing is understanding that being a Jew is being part of a people with culture and with tradition, and using the space we have for theater, for music, for movies that are thought provoking and, spiritually uplifting. So it's not just a place of prayer, but that the synagogue is seen as a living, vibrant community for, yes, spiritual engagement, cultural engagement, and of course, deep learning and meaningful conversations.
And on this journey to get from where you started in the 80s, right, to now, have there been times where other staff have made it much harder for you, or even when you've had various differences in agreement or differences of opinion with, say, the board or other people within the community, and you've had to make some challenging decisions? Have there been moments like that? Even if you don't share the exact moments, or if you, I have to, great. But if you,
I'll just say Kaz and I were talking about this just the other day, and it was kind of like, do you remember this? And then this? And then this and this and this and this. Yeah, there have been quite a few. So getting everything lined up and coalesced has taken a long time. Because it can just be from here or from there. And I don't want to say we're here and there are, because it's just...
How have you navigated that?
Wiser not to.
How have you navigated the differences in opinion?
Sometimes it's been really frustrating, and then I just kind of, I figure I'm here. That's where, I keep coming back to this, the patience and the perseverance. And then I just dig deeper into the, pastoral work, or, I love teaching kids for bar and bat mitzvah. And so I'll just say, okay, that's where I'm getting the meaning out. And that's where I'm having the influence. And, so the bigger picture is kind of on hold for right now. Or, stumbling along. Sometimes you know, has had a toll on one's or on my emotional energy. And, you know, so it does impact. But, you know, you just put one foot after another and know that that's one of the great things about being a rabbi. It is such a multifaceted, you know, way of working that, you know, on a Friday, you know, I'll start off the day at the preschool with little 3 and 4 and 5 year olds and just try to give them, you know, a little insight into life. One of the things they'll do is they'll raise their hand, you know, who made God, you know, and then answering those kinds of questions in a way that you hope a 3 and 4 year old will understand, which is not my forte. But, you know, and they're going, Rabbi Kamen, Rabbi Kamen, Rabbi Ninja, Rabbi, you know, that, and then later in the day, you know, I'll be at the Montefiore home with people in their 90s who are, you know, just beautiful human beings, and having that range. And that's what is so amazing about a synagogue is that, you know, you're engaged with people from 3 to 100, and there are times you're praying together. There's times you're learning together, enjoying, you know, cultural activities together. It's the only place I know. And I'm, you know, obviously churches and mosques and other spiritual communities would be like this as well. But, you know, if you think about most places, they're either very age specific or activity specific, you know, like their sports clubs or their pubs or their this or their that. But, you know, this is, you know, automatically, and that's why I said I didn't start it from scratch. That's what a synagogue is. It's a place where, you know, kind of like from 0 to 100 people come for this, and, you know, incredibly transformative range of activity and communication. And so when those moments of frustration have happened, I've just put my energy elsewhere, even though, you know, I may not wake up in the morning as bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
So is that, so I'm attempting to extract what I think is a pretty valuable lesson about life. Most people get, I haven't met a single person who's gone through a career or even their own entrepreneurial journey who hasn't found that they've had frustrations with people, people that they're supposed to work with, people they're trying to do good work with, people who they need to sign off on something so they can go ahead and do the work that they're actually supposed to do or that they're trying to do. And I haven't met a single person yet who hasn't had frustrations with that. And what you're sharing.
And there
is,
you go. I'm one of them.
You're one of them.
I'm just another one.
Still haven't met a single person. You've let me down, Rabbi.
I don't think you will. I don't think you will. Yeah.
Exactly. And the strategy, the primary strategy that you've shared about how you've managed to overcome it is you put your energy from, like, it sounds like you were finding that if you kept putting your energy into this particular area of trying to push this particular thing forward or not let that particular thing happen, and you kept putting all your energy into it, it would have just gotten you to complete burnout and massive frustration and emotional drain. And you found that there are times when it's better to just put those types of projects on ice, or just put it on hold, focus on what you love doing, find a way to rebuild your energy, and then come back with more rigor and more energy again, with different people or with the same people, but just more persistence.
Yeah. And at the same time, you know, if I see that there is a stumbling block, try to have conversations about how that might be a stumbling block and how that can be dealt with. So I don't sit passively by, you know, and just say, oh, what the hell, you know, that's the way it is. But I do try to have conversations to share with others why I see it as a stumbling block and how we need to, you know, move forward in a better way. And sometimes, oh, here's the word, with more success than others, meaning that, you know, as, you know, what's the outcome? And, you know, sometimes I haven't always gotten, you know, the outcome that I've wanted, or sometimes, you know, when it happens, it takes a lot longer than it, you know, might have. And so, yes, and that's what I do during that period of time. It's not necessarily sit only passively by, but I focus the majority of my energy in places where I can have meaningful work within the life of the synagogue.
Have there been times where you've gotten the outcome that you're working towards that you thought you wanted and then realized, I wish I hadn't pushed that hard because that's not the outcome that I actually wanted in the end? Or I wish I didn't get that outcome. Have there ever been those moments?
Yeah. I don't think, yeah, no, I'd have to really sit with that. But, you know, on first thought, no. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And as I say, and that's also often because, you know, before I really know that, I'll rephrase it. There's what happens is I might have an idea that I think is going to be good, but before I won't like push for it until I've run it by people that I absolutely trust. And as I say, Rabbi Nino is one of them, my whole team, right? So I don't think I don't go into any of these things alone, right? I know always that my team, and when I say my team, that, you know, the five rabbis, and we have another rabbi who works with us, and you know, I don't mean to be disrespectful of her, but she volunteers her time for specific projects. So she's not a full-time employee of the congregation. And so, she does beautiful work with us when she does. That's Rabbi Erna Trigg, about beautiful spiritual meditation programs and things like that. But she's not involved in the same way in the day-to-day running of the congregation and the and its development. So that's why when I talk about the five of us, I'm referring to the full-time employees as rabbis of the synagogue. And we always kind of do things in, a cooperative, consultative way. So I'm never out there on my own. And that's where, you know, something that I might think would be a good thing to do, you know, shown or convinced or whatever you want to say, maybe we should do it this way, maybe that's not it, or something like that.
So a lot of the time people think that the stumbling blocks to getting what they want that you're referring to are always bad things. But you've just shared that a lot of the time they're actually really good things, because then you have the conversations like what you're referring to about how can we overcome it? Mm. How can we make sure that this change happens? And then you start to realize, maybe we don't actually want that change to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. So so far so good, you know, but
so good.
It's been a wonderful journey so far. And the good news is it's not over.
No, it never is, right? Oh, at least not now. And with something like a community that you're creating.
What is going to happen? You know, and I don't, it's interesting here, you know, like people use the word legacy, and I really don't, it's not a word that's important at all to me. But I just want what do I want to be able to do? I want to be able always to be connected to this synagogue, because there's going to be a time when I'm not the senior rabbi. But I always want to be connected and to, you know, have relationship with and do work for the synagogue for quite some time ahead. And at the same time, I want to be able to be involved in broader communal efforts as well. Going back to that, you know, your work is never finished. I really feel, and especially now, the urgency to build a cohesive society the best we can. And as, you know, a religious leader within the Jewish community, I want to do that with other leaders of other parts of the community in Australia. As I said, we're not going to change politics in the Middle East, but we can certainly change and influence society in Australia. And I think Australians are, you know, good, decent people that want that.
And at some point, you won't be able to continue to be involved. Like you won't live forever, unless maybe you do. I don't know. But at some point, you won't. You'll die. Your all of the energy and the connection to the synagogue is.
I think about dying every day.
Yeah. Oh, so many funerals that you run. Is that part of it?
That I don't think of dying because, yeah, every day I'm either dealing with someone who is or officiating at someone who for someone who has, or the aftermath thereof. All of us as rabbis do that. And so it's impossible not to think of one's mortality. And I think in all reality, I do want a time where I am no longer doing the work other than how I behave as a human being. I want to be able to be with my family in Los Angeles a lot more. I go back 3 times a year because my mom's turning 96 and I want to be with her as much as I can while she's alive. And I want to with my with Kaz and our family here to be able to enjoy them and our beautiful grandson. No, I definitely want to just have that as well. And so one doesn't live forever and one gambles, you know. My loved ones have passed away around 70. So, and which is not far if that were to happen to me. And I know it from the work that I do, that, you know, today I'm great in terms of my health. And tomorrow I could be told I have, you know, X, Y, or Z disease that means I only have weeks or months or, you know, not much more to live. So I'm always aware of that. And right now I continue on as if I got years ahead of me. So, I just pray, you know, I've been very, very blessed for 68 years. You know, I'm one of the most fortunate people with good luck. It's a wooden desk you heard me knock on just there. And so, yeah, I would like to have time to just be and enjoy life. There's definitely that.
You say you've spent a lot of time on thinking on mortality, literally every day. What does death mean to you?
Advice to people. Make your death as easy as possible for everyone else. Write a will. Get rid of all the shit in your house that you don't need. Keep your place neat and unencumbered the best you can. Make sure people have your passwords. I've written out for when I die for Kaz. So when the moment comes, and if, you know, there will always be someone who knows what to do. Make it your death. As you say, Harry, it's inevitable. As easy as possible. Know whether you're going to donate organs. So far, mine are good and they're going to be. And make that wish recorded and know. Write a will, as I said. Determine whether you're going to be in Judaism, we are buried, but there are some people who choose cremation. Make that clear and take responsibility for the costing of it ahead of time. Like if you're going to be buried by a grave already. Those kinds of things. So every year I go through my paperwork. Every year I neaten my life up as much as I can to make it easier when that moment comes. I even have a playlist for, I know Jews aren't meant to have music after a funeral. I have some great songs on a playlist for, you know, some kind of memorial. I've written my eulogy. It's, you know, a haiku. So, you know, don't make it complicated. So those are the ways I approach the moment. What I understand, I was just talking to a beautiful, beautiful woman of deep faith who passed away. And I don't know from whom I heard this, but it resonated with me and it resonated with me deeply. And, you know, I've shared it with others, but it has to do with the fact that the infinity before you were born is nothing that is frightening or concerning. And so that's clearly what awaits. Second of all, there's a beautiful teaching by Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav. And you know, kids learn it as a song in Jewish community. Kol alam kulo gesher tsar meod ve'ikar lo lefached klal. And so he takes that concept and he says the whole world is a very narrow bridge. And the main thing is to have no fear at all. It's that narrow bridge between the infinity before and the infinity after. And the metaphor that has rung most true for me, and again, I say I don't know from whence it came, but is of the ocean and the waves. So I'm a person of deep faith that there is the ocean that we call God, and that each of us is a wave within that ocean. And just like there's no two snowflakes that are alike, there's no two waves that are alike. I love the ocean, love the rare moments when I can go in and have a little body surf and play in the waves. And so one day, like all those other waves, my wave will crash into the, you know, the shore, and it will go back into the ocean. And just like all those water molecules remain part of the ocean, you know, that wave will never exist again. Jeffrey Kamens will never exist again. I don't know what the awareness of the molecules is in the ocean, you know, the water molecules. So I don't have a deep sense that, you know, I'll see my grandparents or my dad or Babette, or these are the loved ones, you know, that have passed away, my great auntie, but that's just the way it is. What is, you know, is what will be, you know, when it comes, it will come. And this can lead to all kinds of other conversations. I don't know if you want to have them, you know, conversations about God and faith and, you know, how one manages one's death in terms of illness and stuff like that.
What I am curious about where this is going, that was a beautiful metaphor about the ocean and waves. What I am curious about, though, is in the context of your life, Judaism has played, obviously, a huge role. You're a rabbi, for crying out loud. What specifically, if you can think of some examples, has Judaism taught you about life that has made your life better or has made the life of others better as well?
Okay, so for me, Judaism is a faith-based tradition of our people, and or is the faith-based, you know, so going back to, you know, Don Juan and, you know, Carlos Castaneda, different people have different approaches to life. My father was a person without faith at all. He just believed that the material physical world is all there is. He didn't, you know, when you're dead, you're dead. I remember he was, you know, dying, and it was a week before, actually. It was just very soon before. And I said something about, I raised the question of soul, and he just thought one last time. And he said, don't give me any of that soul bullshit. That was kind of almost, you know, some of his final words to me. And yet for me, as I mentioned earlier, I've always had this deep sense of presence. And so when I began my study of Judaism and learned that the name of God in Judaism that we reference in the Shema, which is our central teaching. I mean, we say it to, you know, traditional people say it to babies when they're born. It's the first words. It's meant to be the last words we say when we die. It's meant to be what we, you know, say as a reflection before we go to sleep every night. And it's just, listen up, Jews, you know, it could be for all humanity, but, you know, the Torah was written by the ancestors for the people. And it says these four letters in Hebrew, Yud Hey Vav Hey, in English, they would be YHVH. But when you actually understand the meaning of them, it's basically the verb to be in its manifestation. So it's basically saying, listen up, Jews, all that was, is, and will be, that is what is God. And all that is, was, is, and ever will be, it's one. And that faith idea resonates deeply with me, that all that was, all that is, all that will be is one. Everything forever is interconnected. So we are just the smallest aspect of this life force. And it's, to me, it's important that the verb is to be, which is totally amorphous and, you know, beyond the material. And the next word, the seventh word, it says, so ve'ahavta, go out with love, with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. And Harry, that is impossible to do 24/7, but it is a great, for me, aspirational and inspirational faith commitment. And in Judaism, and the way the rabbis then constructed this teaching unit that ended up being in the Siddur, the prayer book, and that we reflect on evening and morning, is that it's not just a feeling, this love. It, you know, and this is where the word mitzvah comes in, that it's a commandment, it's an obligation. And I come back to that thing that I said much earlier, that, and so I get this deep sense of we are here with an obligation to serve this life force with love in our heart, in our deepest consciousness, and in everything we do. And therefore, there are actions upon, you know, that are incumbent upon us, actions which it's incumbent for us to refrain from, and speech as well, and all these things. And so it's truly a practice. And I actually try to share these thoughts with the 12-year-old kids I'm teaching for Bar and Bat Mitzvah. I share it in, you know, somewhat simpler ways with those little preschool kids. So these are the things that I talk about. So I try to do this as my daily practice, and it forms the core of my teaching. And then as, you know, being transforms into space and time, I just love the way Judaism deals with time. I mean, our ancestors are the ones, as far as I understand it, that created a unit of time called a week. You know, other forms of time are astronomically, physically based, from the day to the month to the year. But a week is a creation of human consciousness, and to take one day out of seven, and you know, its purpose is very clear in Judaism. It's like to stop, to be, and to understand that every human being deserves freedom. I could go on and on. I mean, there's just so much that I have found in Judaism that enables a life for me of deep meaning and purpose, and gives wonderful foundation and structure. And it's not like I believe that there's some guy in the sky telling me what to do. I would be doing a huge disservice to, you know, my father's memory if that's, you know, where I was holding, and it's not. But I think this is an amazing ancestral path that we continue to adapt and adopt to, you know, help influence a better outcome, if we're going to use that word, for humanity in the 21st century.
So what advice would you give to someone who's listening to this and they're trying to live a more purposeful life? Maybe they're doing well in their career. Maybe they've got kids, a marriage, maybe not. Maybe they're on their own. But they're just trying to make sure that they are living as purposefully as they possibly could. What can you share with them that can help them make that decision?
That's a big question, because, especially obviously I'm not here to proselytize or anything. So everybody's going to have their different faith paths. So make sure, I would say, it's something that is opening your heart. Make sure that it is non-dogmatic. I don't think that's helpful. Make sure it's something, and that is to say, in which you know your curiosity is continuing to grow, and you know your imagination as well, so you're not shutting down those elements of being, but you're helping them to expand. And then within that, I think it's really helpful to have certain practices and disciplines, whatever they may be, you know, where there's certain things that you do. I think body work for me is huge. I don't know if that's the way it is for everyone, but I think body work is very, very important. In Judaism, the body is a sacred vessel, And, you know, you want to look after it, you know, the best way that you can, whatever that is to maintain your health. You know, right diet and right exercise. But I think that also continuing to learn and to grow is such an important thing to, you know, whether it be through podcasts or through reading, and to making sure that you don't get locked down into a silo, into a little box, but that you, you know, allow your mind to expand as much as possible. It's a great gift, the mind, and the imagination. And to, and therefore, I think, you know, to continue to learn with and from as many different people as you can.
Okay. So to summarize, and that was a beautiful point to almost end on. I mean, to summarize some of the key points that you shared in this conversation is that success to you is not about the tangible things. It's about your how to live purposefully and how to basically pursue a sense of fulfillment. And what you just shared is with regards to growth of your imagination and your curiosity to always continue to expand with love in your heart to be able to go through. It's not something neither you responsible or required to do it, but nor can you desist from it. And you've lived your life in accordance with that. The earlier years of your life, you were rather frustrated, right? You didn't really have that much of a sense of purpose. You went to law school, don't know why, I guess it was just the thing to do. And then you became a lawyer for a short time, and you realized that's just not what I want to do at all. And then your wife actually asked you, well, have you thought of becoming a rabbi? And you say, okay, well, that's something that
she wasn't yet my wife. Yeah,
wasn't yet your wife.
We were friends, yeah. And she became my wife. Yeah,
okay, gotcha.
But you were a very good listener.
Oh, thank you. It's my job now. And so throughout all of that, you started realizing, well, I've got to focus on what really will fulfill my purpose. And a big part of that for you was community. You wanted to create a sense of community, and it started out with breaking down a lot of the barriers of the labels that come up with Judaism, Reform, Masorti, Progressive, Orthodox, and all the rest of it. And that's where, if anyone were to refer to your legacy, that's where your legacy has definitely been heading. In terms of creating a community and creating a structure and basically a living entity that's able to continue even after you step down physically, but then also leave entirely and emotionally. And you've shared that the main way that that's grown has been through holding steadfast with your vision and sticking to it, but then also with all the collaboration, both from the people who have believed in you and supported you and pushed you forward, and then also the people that you've been trying to continue to invest in and bring up and continue to help them grow as well, to create what, I mean, if most people looked at your life, they'll be like, hey, that Rabbi Jeffrey Kamitz is pretty successful. Look what he did with Emmanuel. And you've been able to create this kind of new entity that becomes more of a beacon or more of an example for other people to be able to follow. And some of the, I guess, hacks that we can refer to that you've shared have been, if you're getting frustrated with something and you just can't move forward in what's really important for you, then just stop. Find the things that you do love doing and that you know are impactful and do that while you keep trying to find a new way to approach the bigger picture. And there's always for you, it seems like there's this balance of really big picture. These are the big things that I really want to push forward and the big projects I got to work on. And I've got to be able to also just look down at teaching a bar mitzvah or a bat mitzvah student or helping someone who's facing their mortality in the very near future, or the family who just dealt with the death of a loved one, or a family introducing a new child or getting married and all those things. And so you've been able to find the pastoral work and all the different elements around your world have been able to really support and foster growth, both for you, but then also for the vision that you've been creating, which you have a right to speak on because you've actually been very successful in being able to achieve that. Although you'd say, no, it's not tangible. And so the core message I've received from what you've shared is always make sure that you grow. And in fact, you have an obligation to do so, an obligation to not desist from it. You share that we're just waves, that we're going to crash. You think about your mortality every day. But at the end of the day, you've decided, and you've made a very clear decision with a lot of energy and a lot of perseverance, that every day you're going to make sure that you're going to be growing your curiosity, growing your imagination, and growing in the love that you're able to give to others. Is there anything which you'd like to reframe, rephrase, or remove, or add to what I just shared about my summary of the life of Jeffrey Kamen?
Harry, you're very, very, not only a good listener, but very generous in your reflections. I wish I could be that way always. It's the aspiration. I don't always succeed in, you know, the way of life to which I aspire, but it sounds really good coming from you, I have to say. And the other thing that I would just add is that I think it's so important for us to live a life of humility and gratitude. So I'm very grateful for this opportunity, despite my trepidation for years in speaking with you. And the last thing I'd like to share is that as I have tried to break down the board, you know, boundaries and borders within Judaism, I think that's where I would like to continue now the work, is to break down those boundaries and borders that we hold as human beings in our religious identifications, in our national identifications, and all these things, and really try to find the alliances of people who understand that, you know, we are human beings on this beautiful, fragile planet Earth. And the sooner that we can, you know, put fixed ideologies aside and understand that we are part of this, you know, amazing organism that we call planet Earth with all its sentient creatures, and work together, the better it will be for the generations to come. So, you know, there's, as I, there's still plenty of things that we can all hope to do together. And I thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing your wisdom and your insights for all of your years. I appreciate it, Jeffrey.
So I hope you received a whole lot of value from engaging in that conversation. What were the key takeaways for you? What can you schedule in your life right now to make sure that the time you just invested into listening to this exceptional conversation with this amazing mentor and this amazing individual is time that wasn't misused, but was time that you've allocated properly to enhancing your life and improving it? Whatever it is, schedule it now, practice it now, be the successful person you're meant to be, live with purpose.